Sounds True presents Your Buddha Nature, Part 2, The Perfection of Sila, The Virtuous Heart, with Jack Kornfield.
We started by talking about generosity and that poem from Rumi where he says, walking out of the treasury building, I feel generous. Anybody still sober in this weather must be really afraid. The sense of generosity that can come from an open or understanding heart. And others of these qualities that we'll be speaking of are loving kindness, balance, wisdom. Also spoke with the old myth or story or image of the perfection of the Buddha taking 100,000 mahakalpas and four immensities. Remember the length of time if you have a mountain, the height of Mount Everest, and every 100 years the bird comes along with a silk scarf in its beak to wear the mountain away a little bit. When that mountain is worn down as one mahakalpa. And so there are these kinds of descriptions of practicing generosity or cultivating the quality of patience or understanding or compassion. And if you hear them, they become immediately impossible in earth time. How could anyone possibly do that? So they speak of another level, which is the level of that which is timeless or eternal or universal. And that's really the level that the teachings of awakening invite us to understand or perceive from. To step out of the day-to-day routine, even for the time that we sit here, and listen to some greater dance, the music of our hearts, the space within which all our experience arises and passes away, to find that place of knowing. I was rereading again this kind of fun book called The Boy Lama about Lama Yeshe, who I knew as a teacher in the form or body in which he first visited the West, when he was a kind of very jovial, rotund, happy, and extremely charismatic Tibetan Lama who started centers in every continent in the world just about. And then after he died some years ago, he died in California and was cared for by all the students down in the Santa Cruz area. They found this little boy in Spain who was his reincarnation, or so they said, his rebirth. And they brought him to California after finding him. He was like 2 or 3 years old, and he drove him down to Santa Cruz to his monastery. He'd never been there before, and they didn't really give him any training or anything. The car pulled up, and he ran out of the car, and he said, "Oh, what a wonderful stupa you made for me," which is actually the place where Lama Yeshe's ashes had been interred there. No one told him. And then he walked around and looked at the people he knew. This is just 2 or 3 years old, and kind of nodded to them all. Here I am back again. They had some meetings and gatherings. He was there for a while, and he went into one of the meetings, apparently, where they had a lot of conflict they were trying to work out. And he went and he took one of the little Buddhas from the altar and he just went around the circle and he put it on everybody's head, kind of smiled at them and then sat there, and the meeting kind of cooled out after that. So there's something bigger going on here, perhaps, than just the stories that we tell ourselves in getting through the day. How many of you watched the eclipse last week? It's an amazing thing. You can really see the dance of the spheres. There's the moon, and it looked rounder than it usually does. And then there's the whole shadow of the earth passing across it. And you can feel how these immense, huge spheres of stone, and then ours with a little water and life wiggling around on it, are passing one another. You know, in the illumination of our galaxy with our sun. And now this year they've found for the first time, and it keeps happening every month or two, they find new of them. I think there's 10 or a dozen now planets that they found in other stars not so distant from here. So it's in those billions of galaxies, it's filled with this dance of stars and planets. And here we are. And you can feel it not just in the eclipse, but in the change of seasons. You can sense the swing of things. They're in balance for a moment, and then they shift toward darkness for a time, and then they shift back again toward light. And if you sense from this great perspective, there is a kind of harmony within all this movement. This harmony in the spiritual tradition of Buddhism is also called the Dharma, which means the universal law or the truth within which we as humans can find harmony in the midst of the cycles of pleasure and pain and birth and death. But it's not very easy in modern society, quite honestly. This weekend I was part of a meeting to do planning and preparation for a conference coming up in June in San Francisco with the Dalai Lama on violence in our cities and in our country and the alternative of nonviolence. It'll be a large conference, several thousand people, whoever wants to go. And it's not just the Dalai Lama, but we'll also be Maya Angelou and Marion Wright Edelman and Alice Walker and various people who are doing work in the communities in our cities and towns looking for a basis to live together in harmony. And the stories that were here just at the meeting as we began to plan how we were going to bring 200 or 300 or more young men from Oakland and Watts and Los Angeles, East Los Angeles, together so that we're not talking about it, but we really are looking for leaders out of the communities of young people. And how to do it, people who've been in gangs or participated in violence, in such a way that's also not blaming. Because a lot of the violence that we see that has escalated in our society comes from the abandonment of our youth in many places. Or it comes from the incredible growth of greed, so that we are richer and richer as a country basically every year, and yet the distance between rich and poor has grown vastly, certainly in the last decade and a half or two decades. Greed. One of the young men who was part of beginning this organization for the Dalai Lama and others who come was a young man named Tenzin, I believe, who'd only been in America for a year. He was in his late teens. And the year before, he'd walked out of Tibet to Nepal over the Himalayas. You can't do it in the warm season because there's too much rain and it gets muddy. So you have to do it at the beginning of the cold season, but before the snows get too deep. He had walked out with another young man, a young boy who was 12 years old, and when they finally walked into Nepal, the 12-year-old boy who walked with him had such severe frostbite, and they have no hospitalization or care, that most of his fingers were amputated. And you were allowed to stay in Nepal 7 days and then sent to a refugee camp in India. But he said, we had to leave. There was no freedom for us there to say what we thought, to speak our minds, to say our prayers, to love what we loved, and even at the cost of our life, and a number of the children who walked out died, we had to come. When I returned from Dharamsala and meetings with the Dalai Lama this last winter, one of the things I brought back was this drum that's part of the ritual practices, particularly in Vajrayana Buddhism. And it has a couple of little balls that hang on it, and you can turn it and get a particular sound together with a bell. It's made of two skulls, two human skulls. If you look closely, they're the little sutures, the human skulls. And I brought it back and I showed it to my daughter, who said, ew! You know, why would anyone make a drum out of human skulls? And the reason that the drum is made of human skulls, is to sound in, and then there's a trumpet made of a human bone, of a human thigh bone, to go with the bells, is to speak about that which is timeless and deathless. That when one speaks about the laws of the spirit, it's that which transcends even birth and death. In modern times, we have lost the sense of what are eternal values. It's all become relative, so that we move through society like a boat without a rudder. Do you remember the experiment from Psychology 101 that's done sometimes, in which three buckets of water are placed in front of the unwitting psychology students? One of which is filled with ice and water, so it's very cold. One is neutral temperature. And one of which is filled with hot water, so hot that you can just barely hold your hand in it. And a student is called up to the front and asked to plunge their hands and hold them in the two outside buckets, the cold one and the hot one, as long as they can, which is usually about half a minute. Your hand can be in ice water before it gets so painful you have to pull it out. And in very hot water. 30 seconds later, their hands are pulled out, and then they're asked to place them in the center bucket. And when you put your hands in the bucket in the center, usually if you look at the face of the young student at that point, their eyes kind of glaze over, and they get this funny expression, because one hand feels really hot in that water, and the other hand feels very cool and cold, and yet they know that their hands are touching and they're in the same water. Do you understand this? That perception is really relative, isn't it? And because it was in cold, it feels hot, and because it was in hot, it feels cold. This is kind of what's happened to values in our culture, integrity. It's okay to cheat a bit on your taxes. You just have to figure out the right place. Or maybe it's not. I don't know. Or to drive over the speed limit, and I'd certainly do it, you know, as long as nobody's looking. But not to drive too unsafely or whatever. Or it's okay to kind of find ways to make or keep a great deal of money that are legal, but, oh, I don't know. I think that Wall Street has a lot of ways to do it that are kind of ethical and maybe kind of not. And it surrounds us. In the midst of this, what is true or universal justice and virtue and ethics? For that's what I'd like to speak about, is the second of these perfections of our own nature. Our Buddha nature, is the quality of a virtuous heart. And what is true virtue is like a crown. It's the adornment of human life, the crown for a king or a queen, for those who harm none but serve that which is true and good and just, their life is transformed. Now, often these qualities of human true nature or Buddha nature are illustrated in the old days by animal stories, the 500 animal stories of past lives of the Buddha. And in one of these, one such story, long time ago when you were somewhat younger than you are now, and when you lived in India, which I'm sure you all did, because a lot of people do now, and I'm sure a lot did before. The Buddha was born as a prince who became a righteous and just king. In fact, his justice and righteousness became known throughout the world in the same way that King Solomon's was known at another time. It became so known that, as it's told in this story, the gods in the heavens began to feel something strange going on down on earth. "Have you heard what's happening down there?" one said to another. "Oh yes, I could feel it. There is this king of righteousness. So they decided, well, he might be and he might not be. Let's go test him. So such stories are told. And so one of the gods looking over the portals or down to sea in the world said, I will go. And he tumbled off his throne, wherever he was. And as he did, he turned into first one beautiful bird, a dove, and then shortly after, a second bird, a hawk. And the dove flew down through the air and into the window of the palace where the king sat on his throne, panting, feeling very dove-like by the time it got all the way down there through the air, and rested on the arm of the king on this throne and spoke to the king, as only a god in the animal disguise can do, and said, save me, help me, I am being chased by a hawk that would catch and eat my flesh. And the king looked at the dove and said, I allow no such harm in my kingdom, I will protect you. And then, whoop, 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 whoop. On the other arm came a great big hawk and looked at the king and said, you've got my dove. The king said, the dove is not yours, the dove is the dove's dove. And it doesn't happen to belong to anyone, and I'm here to protect it. And the hawk turned an eye to the king and said, then what will I eat? The king says, well, what do you need to eat? And the hawk said, I live only on fresh meat, and that's my dinner. You may protect one, but if I don't eat, I too shall die. You are a just king. Give me justice. What to do? King was in a tough spot. He sat for a bit, reflected. He had given his sacred word, I will protect the dove. Yet he could not imagine killing another creature for the hawk. Finally, he called to his attendant, bring my sword and scales and a cloth. He brought his sword and scales and a cloth, and he took the cloth and he pulled up his royal pants leg and tied it as tight as he could around his thigh and took the scales and said, here, sit in this side to the dove. And the dove sat in the scales and then raised his sword and said to the hawk, I can kill no other, so I will offer you of my own flesh. Cut out a piece of his own leg and put it on the scale. They're gory. You know how fairy tales are. It's just how it's... Jack and the Beanstalk, it's all the same, you know. Bloody though it was, but the scale didn't move. And the hawk said, not enough. Cut off another piece and another until he could hardly move and fell down in a faint on the floor. And at that moment, the hawk and the dove merged into one in this great golden light, and out of the light appeared a god who reached over and touched the king, who was restored, as in all these stories, to his bodily well-being, and then bowed to the king and said, we had heard of your justice, we had heard of your righteousness, and we came to test you. And you will reign long, and your kingdom will prosper indeed. And then went back up to heaven. So that's the story. Then you hear it and you say, all right, how can a human being measure up to that? I mean, this is really the archetype, isn't it? It's something mythological. And yet, the story points to the enormous power of our virtue. In these confusing times, it used to be that a man or a woman took an oath, and not lightly, whenever they spoke, that our words really meant a lot to our honor, that we stood by our character. It was so. And a great deal comes from that. Margaret Mead wrote, don't say that a small group of committed people can't change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. my teacher Ajahn Chah, other teachers I've studied with, they love to talk about virtue. It was one of his favorite things in spiritual life. The joy of living a life of integrity. The peace that comes from living a life of integrity. The sanity of the world that comes to us by living with a virtuous heart. All of spiritual life rests on it. All of it. I mean, in the simplest way, as I've said, it's very hard to meditate after a day of killing and stealing. You know, try it. You know? It's not conducive to a quiet mind and an open heart, is it? And without this inner sense of integrity, it's like getting in a rowboat and rowing while the line is still tied to the dock. All the other spiritual practices, you meditate and you do this or that, without virtue, there is no spiritual life. I mean, any state or vision or, you know, understanding that you could get is simply delusion, worthless, if it's not grounded in the activities, the actions of our life. Because spirituality isn't about experience. You can have all kinds of experiences. It's about a spiritual life. There are three levels to this power of virtue or the integrity of the heart. The first is called limiting harm, non-harming. And it is what allows us to enter the human realm. It's said that until we find that truth in ourselves that allows us not to harm one another, we still live in the realm of beasts and hungry ghosts and nightmares. And that even though we have a human body, we're not a human being until we have awakened that place of virtue, that kind of attention. And in this first level of limiting harm, we undertake to refrain from activities that harm other beings. It's the ground of our spiritual life. I won't purposely cause suffering to another being. Ruth Dennison, one of the teachers that comes through Spirit Rock and an elder in our community, was leading a day-long here a couple of years ago. It's time for walking meditation, and she was out in the parking lot. She went out that way, and she saw the sheriff's car sitting there, because sometimes the sheriff likes to pull his car in here and read the paper or have a cup of coffee, or just it's a kind of place he can get out of the traffic and rest for a little bit. And so she went over and introduced herself, told him a little bit about Spirit Rock, and said, you know what we do here, she said in her kind of German accent, what we're doing here, we're helping you. Very, very fundamental. So the traditional way of understanding this non-harming is the five trainings of the heart that are undertaken as a practice of awareness so that we are aware as we live in the world. And the first of these five trainings of the heart is not to kill other beings or hurt them. Remember the cartoon during hunting season in the New Yorker where the deer are talking on the hillside and one deer turns to the other. Why don't they thin their own goddamn herds? You know? It's not too many deer, maybe. But I remember somebody asking the Dalai Lama about shooting a horse that was old or that had broken a limb. And he said, well, if your child broke a leg, would you shoot him or her? That was his answer. It's the principle of, if possible, in any way, not to kill or harm another life. And then the second training of the heart is on no account to steal that which belongs to another. You know what stealing does in the world, what kind of a world it creates when people steal from one another. The repercussions of paranoia and violence and defense and all of the things. As a monk, if you steal something worth more than a nickel, you are automatically disrobed and no longer a monk for the rest of this lifetime. It's that important. The third of these trainings is to not speak falsely, not to misuse speech in lying, gossip, or slander. In my beginning classes, I've always talked about this experience. My partner, Joseph Goldstein, decided he wasn't going to gossip at all for a period in his meditation training, which meant not even positive gossip. He simply wasn't going to talk about someone that he knew when they weren't present. Only to them, but not about somebody. And he undertook this as a practice for a month. He said it was amazing. 90% of my speech was eliminated. Not to speak falsely, not to lie under any circumstance. The fourth is to not harm through the misuse of sexuality. Adultery, all the kinds of pain. How many people have experienced pain in their sexual relations? Don't bother. We know. It has an enormous power and force in our life, doesn't it? To not do it in ways that cause suffering. And you know, you'll know when someone's suffering, it's pretty straightforward. And the last of these trainings of the heart is not to abuse alcohol, drugs, or intoxicants in any way, not to do them in any way that you lose awareness. 10 million drug addicts, 20 million alcoholics in this country alone, the majority of auto fatalities, the majority of home fires, the majority of child abuse, the amount of suffering that comes from the misuse of alcohol and intoxicants is incredible. Not to do it. This is called basic humanity. It's like somebody asked Spencer Tracy about his acting. He said, just know your lines and don't bump into the furniture. That's basically what you're asked to do up there. And it's the same thing. It's basic spiritual life to not harm another being. The second level, after limiting our harm, is actually expressing or cultivating compassion. Rather than refraining from harm, it's turning it around and letting our virtue extend through our thought and word and deeds. So if you stand in the rowboat and you call out, come here, come hither, other shore, how far do you get? The idea is not just to refrain from harm, but to see that we're all in the same boat, to untie it from the dock and be the big ferry boat. Takes everybody across. There is an inner empowerment that comes when we see that all life is our life, our uncles and aunts, our brothers and sisters, that we are one of so many creatures, all breathing the same air, drinking the same water, stepping on the same earth. And so how we drive and use our water and respond to those who are homeless and to need around us and to injustice, not just to refrain from harm, but to make our virtue proactive. So that not killing turns into a reverence for all life. Where you really love life because it's what we are and it's precious, like Chief Seattle's web of life that we share. The single garment of destiny Martin Luther King spoke about. And it's not an easy thing to not kill. If you look more broadly, what does that mean about people who are hungry in other parts of the world? And the food we eat, or the money we have, the way we live? Or what does it mean when there are animals that are bothering you? rats, roaches, you know, little things which don't like to be killed either, you'll notice. Right? They don't. I remember there at one Zen center, there were all these roaches, at Katagiri Roshi's center. And, you know, it's one thing to sit in the Zendo and have the roaches go by, and you just kind of note that in your meditation, right? seeing or whatever you're feeling about roaches, interest or disgust or something. But it's another when they multiply and you open the brown rice and there's roaches in it, and you open the, you know how it is, right? And so they went to the Roshi and they said, what are we going to do? We've tried, we put boric acid around, you know, or we've tried, we talk to the roaches, but they're multiplying, there are more of them, and it's Minnesota, it's cold out, they want to come indoors, you know. We took this precept not to kill anything, but it's gotten so bad people don't even want to come here because there's roaches in the food. Yeah? And in the Zendo, what do we do? Is it okay? Could we maybe get those little roach motels? And Katagiri Roshi looked back and he said, I'm not going to tell you. Because the point isn't that there is some absolute rule. The point is that as human beings, again and again, we have to wrestle with our heart and this precept or this teaching to not harm another being. It is a practice of awakening. To not steal is the same thing. Turned around as not killing becomes reverence for life. To not steal is a respect for the earth and a concern for justice and for sharing of what we have. And it's particularly hard in the time when there is the absence of the sacred in much of the culture, where there's an absence of elders to speak for the truth. When there is so much racism and injustice and violence, you know, and yet it matters in even the smallest things. We live with care because we know it matters to other beings. I was reading the history of the Quakers, and when they moved out of Pennsylvania to Ohio and further west, this particular account I read was of a series of Quaker families who would take the Indians in that were being murdered left and right for their land, genocide. One particular account of two old Quaker women lived in a farmhouse and they took in this Indian family even though it was illegal to harbor an Indian in Ohio or wherever it was. And the people came and said, you know, you've got to give them back. And they said, you'll have to kill us first to take them. This is from William Faulkner. He writes, some things you must always be unable to bear. Some things you must never stop refusing to bear. Injustice and outrage and dishonor and shame, no matter how young you are or how old you've got, not for fame, not for cash, your picture in the paper or money in the bank, neither. Just refuse to bear them. The compassion of not lying turns into a caring for the truth among people, to speak what is true and helpful. When one is about to admonish another, says the Buddha, there are five qualities to attend to. In due season will I speak, not out of season. In truth will I speak, not in falsehood. Gently will I speak, not harshly. To their profit will I speak, not to their loss. And with kindly intent or compassion will I speak. So that this power, this human gift of words, is used to sow harmony rather than discord, to bring awakening rather than strife or conflict. It's one of the great practices in our spiritual life, right speech or wise speech. How do we use the energy of our words? It means you have to listen to your heart and be really attentive or caring as these words pour out. And what a transformation of life it becomes. The fourth of these, the second level of compassion, is not just not harming through sexuality, but the power of eros. There's a chapter I'm starting to work on in this new book that's going to take me forever to finish on what really happens in spiritual life. And part of it is on the erotic, because I heard from one master that I was interviewing that as you become wiser in his tradition, he said, you also become sexier. Maybe that was just personally appealing, but he actually explained it in the, not the sexual sense, but in the sense of the love of life, of eros, of love itself. And that there is a kind of intimacy and beauty and mystery that comes in our living in human bodies and in this energy of connection between us, that not only can we refrain from harm, but that can bring intimacy, beauty, communion, really something mysterious and deeply spiritual alive. Sexuality is very close to birth and death, isn't it? And it's really a gateway, or it can be, for that mystery, for the sacred. And the last, to not abuse intoxicants, it's turning with compassion, is the seeking of the spirit. To do whatever it is that nourishes our heart, that awakens us. Periods of silence, time in the mountains, walking in the beach, great music, a regular meditation practice that reminds us again and again of that place of awakening. Remember the story from Chuang Tzu, where he said, a drunken man who falls out of a cart, though he may suffer, does not die. His bones are the same as other people, but he meets his accident in a different way. His spirit is in a condition of security. He's not conscious of riding in the cart, neither is he conscious of falling out. Ideas of life, death, fear, and the like cannot penetrate his breast, and so he does not suffer from contact with objective existence. If such security is to be got from wine, how much more is it to be got from the Tao, the spirit? So it's seeking that which nourishes the spirit in awakening. This level of compassion knows that life is complicated, but the intention of the heart to care for all, for the preciousness of life, the beloved, transforms our action. So there's not harming, that's entering the human realm. There's the expression of virtue, which is that compassionate heart. And the third is called adisila, or that virtue which is inherent as our true nature, as our heart's longing, of our essence. When the fear of death or insecurity or self-interest, when that small sense of self drops away even for a moment, and we realize that what matters so much more is simply our presence in this eternal moment. It's really why we sit, in part, to remember that place, to step out of what's called the body of fear and all the things we're afraid of, and go, ah, yes, this mystery here that we're born into. You know, a couple of years ago, when the Gyuto monks who do that, oh, that wonderful Tibetan multivocal chanting came through here, it was also arranged, I think through Seva Foundation, that they would go in and chant in San Quentin, or sing. They went into San Quentin, not for the whole prison, but for a portion of them, and they were to sing together with the San Quentin Men's Christian Choir, sing kind of opposite them. And one of my friends who was part of arranging this visit said that she went into the prison, and the Christian choir there was mostly made of African-Americans, big, beautiful black men, she said, who obviously had also spent time pumping iron and just kind of amazing, you know, physical presence and voices. And then in came the Gyuto monks, who are these slight little guys in dresses, basically, right? It's true. And for the men in there, they didn't know nothing about Tibet or these people, you know, and these young guys, and some young, some older, wearing dresses and very slight and probably looking kind of heathen to them, especially because this was a very kind of evangelical Christian group. But the person who set it up understood something deeper and so did a introduction and said, I want to introduce you. They introduced the old abbot and the monks. They said, I want to introduce these men to you before they sing for you, and I want you to understand some of their history. They're exiles. They can't go back to their home. It's been taken over. And most of these men have spent years in prison. And many of them have been tortured and then had to walk over the highest mountains on the face of the earth to come out and find their brothers and join in a monastery. And one of the things they've had that have carried them through all these years is their prayers and their songs. So that kind of introduction, as you can imagine, all of a sudden they were seen with new eyes. And they began to chant, oh, you know, and then the San Quentin men's choir did their gospel chanting. And then they all just embraced one another and wept. Adisila is that virtue which is the virtue of our true nature, of the benevolent king or queen within us, that sees whoever it is in front of us and acts to bestow justice and beauty, because that's how the world appears to us. The saints are what they are, says Thomas Merton, not because their sanctity makes them admirable to others, but because the gift of sainthood makes it possible for them to admire everybody else. It gives them a clarity of compassion that can find good in the most terrible criminals. It delivers them from the burden of judging others and condemning others. It teaches them to bring the good out of all beings by their own compassion, mercy, and pardon. That's the highest level of virtue. It's the virtue where our acts come because we see the beauty of the world and we are connected to that which is timeless. No matter what someone has done or what we have done, there is in any moment an access we have to what is righteous and whole and wise. In a moment, we can drop it. We can drop the past, the conflict, the things that bind us. People complained to Gandhi. They said, you're not consistent. You know, you have us do this and then you have this. You're not being consistent, especially when he changed the whole way that they were approaching the marches in India to try and find their freedom. He came out from his day of meditation that he took once a week and said, we're going to do it all differently, and they were really upset. And he said, my commitment is not to consistency, but to truth. And that is the place of this inherent virtue. It comes from our heart when we rest in this place of knowing what we most deeply value and who we are. Each act is the act of a Buddha and comes from an inexhaustible purity. Each act can bring a blessing to another. Several years ago, a friend of mine called from prison in Thailand, Sulak. He's an activist and a wonderful man who likes to get himself locked up because he protects the last rainforest in Southeast Asia and the tribes who are being killed and the democracy that's being lost, and he speaks out about it. And I got a telex about him being in jail, and I sent back a whole letter of appeal and stuff. And I knew that by doing it, I might never again be able to get a visa to go to Thailand. So I had to think about it for a while, because my teachers are there, and I love that place. And then I realized that I valued the truth of what he said so much more than that, that I sent it. Fortunately, they didn't keep very good track of it, and I'm able to go anyway. The scent of sandalwood and tagara travels with the wind, but virtue rises even to the gods, says the Buddha. And I speak about this not to set some ideal where you judge yourself, I'm this or that, we're all human, but to remind us of our true nature. It's like a spiral. Sometimes all we can do is to not harm another. I bow to that, that moment when all you can do is bite your tongue and not do that which would cause another harm. I bow to that. And sometimes, in some moments, it's the king and queen in us that sees, that loves others, that gives, that cares through our words and deeds. And sometimes it's as if we're touched by the gods. Sometime in your life, wrote Daniel Berrigan, hope that you might see one hungry man, the look on his face when the bread finally arrives. Hope that you might have baked it or bought it or even kneaded it yourself. And for that look on his face, for your meeting his eyes across a piece of bread, you might be willing to lose a lot, to suffer a great deal. Think about that as you act in the world. Let's sit for a moment. In this moment of sitting, reflect about where it is, in what moments or places your virtue shines, where the integrity of your heart has really shined forth. And sense how it feels to speak and act and think from such a place. And then, quite honestly, reflect as well on what virtues ask for more attention, more consciousness and mindfulness, a greater respect.
This concludes part two of Your Buddha Nature with Jack Kornfield. Our program continues with part three.